Welcome to Pardes Daily, where you get your daily dose of Torah with Pardes faculty. For the next 2 weeks, Pardes is bringing Purim to you. Let's dive in.
Hello, welcome to Pardes Daily. This is Alex Israel from Alon Shavuot, and we're going to be discussing today chapter 3 of the Book of Esther. Achar ha'dvarim ha'ele, after these things, gidal ha'melech Ahasuerus et Haman ben Hamdata Agagi. Sometimes afterwards, Ahasuerus promoted Haman ben Hamdata, the Agagite. He advanced him, seated him higher than any of the fellow officials. All the king's courtiers in the palace knelt and bowed down low to Haman, for such was the king's order. Korim umishtachavim lahaman. But Mordechai lo yichra v'lo yishtachaveh. And the king's courtiers in the palace say to Mordechai, Madua ata over et mitzvat hamelech? Why are you defying the king's order? Vahi ka'omram elav yom v'yom v'lo shamay lehem v'yagidu lahaman lirot hayamdu divrei Mordechai ki gid lahem asher hu Yehudi. When they spoke to him day after day and he wouldn't listen to them, they told Haman in order to see whether Mordechai's resolve would prevail, for he explained to them that he was a Jew. This whole chapter rests on the fact that Mordechai refuses to bow down to Haman, and out of this comes the decree to annihilate the Jewish people. I have to say that this is most curious, and the Megillah itself gives us no explicit understanding as to why it is that Mordechai is so intransigent. Mordechai refuses to do this. I can well imagine op-eds in newspapers and blogs and what have you talking about Mordechai and how his ridiculous stand, his hardline stand, is endangering the entire Jewish people. And so it would seem. And yet, in the context of the Megillah, first of all, we understand what an evil man Haman is, wanting to destroy a whole people because of the acts of a single individual, and how dangerous indeed Haman is. And it seems like possibly Mordechai knew what he was doing. Having said that, there is an opinion in the Talmud which wishes that Mordechai had never been born because he was the one who caused all this trouble. So we should be aware that there is a variety of opinion even on this point. But let's try and analyze and get behind this question. Maybe the key is in the first verse. In chapter 1, we saw there were 7 advisors of the king. In fact, Shiva Ro'ei Pnei HaMelech. Only 7 advisors who were allowed to talk to the king, but there were definitely 7. And now, after these things, Ahasuerus raises Haman above all of the other advisors and puts him into an exclusive position. Why after all these, after these things? What things? Well, maybe it refers to the end of the last chapter where there was an assassination attempt on the king's life, Bigtan and Teresh trying to kill the king. Could it be that Haman was the strong man of the kingdom? He was the person, the chief of police, the head of the secret services. He was somebody who represented power and order. And the king promoted him to have exclusive authority, to be able to put him in a position whereby he would keep the king safe. And now Haman finds himself with enormous power. And how does he use this power? He uses it in order to assure that everybody bows down to him. He's not the king. Usually you bow to the king. Haman wants to see himself glorified and magnified. So why is Mordechai not bowing down? Here we see some very fascinating opinions in the rabbinic corpus. According to one opinion, he had a sort of idolatrous image sewn into his suit, or he was wearing a necklace which contained an idol. And the reason why he wanted everybody to bow down was because he wanted everybody to bow down to an idol. And Mordechai, as a loyal Jew, refused to do that. That's one very interesting option. Another option that we hear, the Midrash in Esther Rabbah, where they put, what did Mordechai answer when he was asked, why did you defy the royal edict? Rabbi Levi said, he told them, Moses, our teacher, warned us in the Torah, cursed is the man who makes an idol a molten image. And this evildoer makes himself into a source of worship. I think that these two, which focus on idolatry, are really quite fascinating, because the world of idolatry is a world of power. The head of the pantheon is who you serve, and the head of the pantheon is always the god who has power over all the little other gods, and he has the ability to destroy them at will and command them at will. And there seems to be a very innate antithesis between the whole Jewish state of being and somebody who wants to put themselves up as almost like a god. And it seems like Mordechai instinctively understood that somebody who is given exclusive power, somebody who wants to wield that power and have everybody bow down to him and be treated like a god, right? That this is something which is really quite toxic. There are other approaches as well. According to one, Mordechai and Haman had a past history in the army. If you can imagine that these people are both high up in the echelons of government, they must have brushed shoulders in the past. And indeed, there is a story in the Elkut Shimoni that they both served in the army together. They were both managing, each of them, half of the military. However, Haman used all of his funds. He spent all of his money, where Mordechai still had plenty of finances. And Haman was really out of all of his money, and he was on the verge of death. And he asked for a loan from Mordechai, who only loaned him on condition that he would be subservient to him. Again, I think what I see from this story is that Mordechai has some past history with Haman, and he really feels that he's irresponsible, that he cannot be trusted, neither with the king's coffers, with the king's money. Isn't it so interesting that when Haman goes to ask the king whether he can kill the Jews, he does this with 10,000 pieces of silver. Some people argue that he gave him 10,000 pieces of silver because, of course, if he kills all the Jews, he'll lose tax revenue. So Haman is trying to move out of the way any arguments the king might have for not annihilating the Jews, and saying, listen, I'll pay you all their tax money, but this is a bribe. In other words, this Midrash, which says that Haman is sort of free and loose with the money, and that somehow he owes Mordechai, shows that in the course of their political career, Mordechai became quite convinced that Haman was a person you couldn't trust, that Haman is willing to use to his own disposal royal resources, and therefore we wouldn't want him to be in charge either. A final approach sees Mordechai's opposition as almost like a rejection of some sort of oppression, as some sort of inability to have your individuality. In Esther Rabbah, they compare that when they say to Mordechai, Vahi Komram Elav Yom Vayom, they said to him every day to bow down, and they compare this to Potiphar's wife, who is trying to seduce Joseph. And it's there in Bereshit, chapter 39, it says, Vahi Kedabra El Yosef Yom Yom. The people speak to Mordechai every day, and they say to him, bow down. And Potiphar's wife says to Joseph, right, every single day, lie with me, shichvi imi, and he refuses. What's the allusion to Joseph? Joseph is the one who manages to keep his Jewish identity, who managed to keep his morality, even while he is in exile, even while he is divorced from his roots and from his family. And somehow, what we might say here, maybe I'll bring another midrash, which talks about how Mordechai refused to bow to Haman. And Haman says to Mordechai, because Haman is descended from Esav, he says to Mordechai, but your grandfather, Jacob, bowed to my grandfather, Esau. And he says, wait, I'm descended from Benjamin, and Benjamin wasn't born at that point. I'm not going to bow down to you because my father, Benjamin, wouldn't bow down to you. What's happening here, is a refusal to bow on the basis of my Judaism. But as if as were argued, Mordechai isn't necessarily such a prominent Jewish personality. What could it be? And I think this is what we've seen in all sorts of societies, where you have a sort of despotic ruler who demands that everybody be the same. that everybody bow, that everybody kowtow, that everybody take on a particular ideology or a particular way of life. And Mordechai realizes that this is a deep threat to his Judaism. It's a deep threat to his own particular identity. And then when we have regimes who try and steamroll over everybody, then any particular identity is going to get eradicated. And he felt that this was deeply wrong. So we have, if you want, three different approaches. One approach which rejects the notion of somebody who sees himself as filled with power. And that is the objection. The other one is maybe a personal objection to Haman as a personality, that he's not a responsible ruler. And the third one is this rejection of the flatlining of identity. We don't all need to be the same in any society. Different groups need to be able to keep their own identities. It is quite terrifying to think about how the rage of one single Haman, at one Mordechai who refuses to bow, will be taken out on the entire people. And therefore, when we read later on in the chapter that Haman issues a decree to all the king's provinces to destroy, massacre, and exterminate all the Jews, young and old, children and women, on a single day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, that is the month of Adar, and to plunder all their possessions, Ushlalam Lavoz, it is quite shocking. However, let me finish with this point. The way that this date was chosen, the 13th of Adar, which is the day before Purim, is that a lottery was made. And that's where we get the word Purim, the Pur, which means a lottery. When was this lottery cast? We're told that it was done in the first month. That's the month of Nisan. And in fact, the letters go out on the 13th of Nisan. In other words, on the 13th of Nisan, that's the first month, the decree is made to kill the Jews. And nobody lifts a finger for 11 months. Nobody does anything. Nobody kills a Jew. Nobody spits at one in the street, I don't know, for 11 months. This shows us what an orderly society Persia was. Quite amazing. What a legal society it was. However, it also shows how terrible this decree was. Because essentially for 11 months, you have all the anti-Semites, maybe we might say, just simple opportunists in every single kingdom of the 127 provinces. And they know that in 11th month time, on the 13th of Adar, the 13th of the 12th month, they have free rein to be able to kill. And in fact, they're meant to go and annihilate the Jews. In the meantime, they can eye up Mr. Goldberg's mansion or Mr. Greenberg's car or Mr. Cohen's factory. Because Ushlalam Lavoz, there's an incentive here. Whoever you kill, you can take their stuff. You can get rich over this. And therefore, this decree is absolutely horrific. The sense of order, the sense of the totality of the decree, and that for 11 months, nobody even lifts a finger, but everybody's eyeing them up and everybody's deciding what they're going to take and who they're going to kill, just waiting for the day to begin where they can do their horrific deeds. So that's it for our discussion on chapter 3. Next time we'll start beginning to see the tables turning a little bit. Tune in again tomorrow for chapter 4.
Thank you to our Pardes faculty, and a big thanks to you, our learners. Make sure to check back in every day to stay on track with your learning, and visit www.pardes.org.il for more information about other ways to learn with Pardes.